Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Charlie Cook is in for Jim Garrity today from National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus from Radio America. We've got good, bad, and crazy martinis for you as usual. Charlie, it's always good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks to a poor Skype connection today. Charlie's on the phone, but we wanted to make sure his thoughts were as clear as possible for all our listeners. Let's start with the good martini, Charlie. And we already knew that it was going to be a pretty optimistic year for Republicans trying to take back the U.S. Senate. Yes, there's still a 55-45 split, so the mountain is pretty high to climb. But because Democrats did so well in 2008, there's a lot of seats that they hold that Republicans can now potentially take a shot at. And according to The Hill and according to a lot of different people watching these races, the list of possible pickups is getting bigger and bigger. And obviously that improves the odds of getting the seats necessary. They now believe Michigan, Iowa, and Virginia are in play, although I think a lot of people would suspect that those are still more likely than not to stay Democratic, at least a couple of those. They're looking very good in South Dakota, West Virginia, Montana, Arkansas, Alaska, North Carolina, Louisiana, and some believe that if Scott Brown gets in New Hampshire, that could be a very tight race, with Republicans only needing to play defense probably in Kentucky and Georgia most especially. So, Charlie, how bullish are you looking at the map?
Well, I think it's probably worth saying that two things have simultaneously happened here. The first is luck. That is that the map just looks good for Republicans this year. The seats that are up for grabs, by and large, in conservative districts, there have been a series of retirements. And so going into it, Republicans always had an advantage, even if the political situation had remained constant. But the political situation has not remained constant, and that's really the second point. As we talked about last time, Obamacare really is a huge issue, and the pendulum has swung. The 2008 was a big Democratic year, in part because of issues such as Iraq, but also because Republicans had been in power in the White House for 8 years, and people were sick of them. A lot of Republicans were sick of them as well. This is sort of the perfect storm. Now, the reason that it really matters is not just that 5-seat deficit that you mentioned. The reason this really matters is because Republicans do tend to do the best they possibly can to screw up opportunities that they're given. If they have a few more opportunities in places like Michigan, that means chances of a Todd Akin ruining the shot at the majority is limited. Am I bullish? Well, politics changes very quickly. Obamacare could become less of an issue by the time that this really matters. On average, though, I do think that politics tends to swing from side to side, and this year is probably the year in which it swings in Republicans' favor as it did in 2010. So I wouldn't be surprised to see them take the Senate or at least tie it.
And, of course, a tie would still leave it in Democratic hands, with Joe Biden breaking the ties there. The vice president is the president of the Senate. And, of course, Harry Reid has vowed to stay on as majority leader till, 2023 or something? So
the one thing I would say about the tie is that you're absolutely right. That would leave it in Democratic hands, and it would leave it effectively in Harry Reid's hands. But the pressure that led the Republicans to winning 5 seats, if that happens, would still be there after they had won the 5 seats. And it would not be too difficult for Republicans sometimes to find just one or two nervous Democrats, perhaps, who are up in 2016 to peel off and vote with them. So although, yes, a tie would be still in Democratic hands, it would be a very different Senate.
And we'll obviously be getting a better picture of these races when the nominees are selected, mostly through primaries. Some states have very crowded primaries. Also, there might be a couple through conventions as well. So we'll see how that all plays out. 6 months from now, I think we'll have a much better picture of what to expect and what the odds are for Republicans and conservatives headed towards November. All right, on to the bad martini now. And this got a lot of attention over the weekend. Andrew Cuomo, the Democratic governor of New York, was doing an interview with WCNY Radio on the show, The Capitol Press Room, Friday morning. He was being interviewed by a woman named Susan Arbetter. And here's what the governor had to say about tolerance, I guess, in his state, who belongs and who doesn't.
Their problem is not me and the Democrats. Their problem is themselves. Who are are they? Are they these extreme conservatives who are right to life, pro-assault weapon, anti-gay? Is that who they are? Because if that's who they are, and if they are the extreme conservatives, they have no place in the state of New York.
Reminds a lot of people of the cities trying to ban Chick-fil-A from coming in a couple of years back. Charlie, no place in New York for people who are pro-life, anti-gay, as he puts it, or pro-assault weapons. I'm guessing when you go to work, you're not so comfortable downtown anymore.
Well, I'm two of those three things. I'm certainly not anti-gay, but I am right to life, and I am pro-assault weapons. I think Andrew Cuomo has forgotten his role in American society, which is that he is an employee, and he is elected by a majority, but he is nonetheless paid by everybody, and he is there to represent and to work for everybody. He doesn't get to decide that there are some views that he can merely label extreme and then exclude from his conception of what constitutes a New Yorker. That aside, I'm confused as to why he said that, unless he actually believes it. It's general knowledge that Andrew Cuomo would like to be president, but he does seem to be doing everything he can to make sure that that never happens. He signed the SAFE Act, which is the most extreme gun law in the country, and had choice words for gun owners at the time. Now he's picking on the anti-abortion movement, and that will, of course, include clergy and a number of other people who are traditionally welcomed in a free society. Maybe he's running through a list, seeing how many people he can possibly irritate before he tries to become president. I don't know. But it does seem an odd electoral strategy.
Charlie, you get a pretty good sense about just how liberal that city is and how liberal the state is. Is this something he's going to face a lot of heat for, maybe have to issue some sort of statement about, or is the state so far left that he's going to skate pretty clean here?
I don't think he will have to apologize for it, but I don't think that that has anything to do with the state. I think that has everything to do with the media. Mm-hmm. The media will look at what he said and say, well, none of those things applies to me. I mean, had he come out and said the opposite, it would have been equally outrageous. Had he said that pro-choicers and gun controllers and I'm not even sure what the equivalent of anti-gay is, because that's such a cartoon version of what it is the conservatives believe. But let's say those who are in favor of gay marriage, which I am, had he added that as the third element, then I'm sure the press would have been all over it, because he would have been saying to the press that they weren't welcome in New York. We probably have even heard some First Amendment talk. Now, I don't think that's the reason why. New York is actually a funny state in some regards. There was a poll that came out this morning that showed that 56% of New Yorkers are against marijuana legalization. And it's really two states. I mean, New York City is extremely liberal, as you say, and de Blasio's election shows that. But when you go up to the north of the state, you do find a lot of very different people, many of whom will be bothered by what Cuomo said, because they are pro-assault weapon and pro-life and so forth. No, I think he's in some regards mistaken New York City and possibly the people he associates with at Albany for the whole state. It is a more diverse state than people think.
Let's go on to the crazy martini now. And Charlie is a frequent sub for Jim on the Three Martini Lunch. And one of those times we've talked about the big debate down in Texas last year about restricting most abortions to before the 20-week mark. There was also part of that legislation that mandated that doctors who perform abortions have to have admitting privileges at hospitals, and there were other provisions in there as well. Ultimately, the bill became law. It's now being challenged in the courts. But before it became law, it was temporarily filibustered by State Senator Wendy Davis, famous for her pink tennis shoes, and she had a catheter and all this stuff. So she's this heroine of the pro-choice movement, and now, of course, she's trying to parlay that into a successful run for governor, which is a pretty steep climb in a state like Texas. But it's getting off to a rocky start. Here's how it was written about at Breitbart.com. Wendy Davis, the Texas state senator whose filibuster for abortion rights made her a Democratic superstar and launched her campaign for governor, has admitted to the Dallas Morning News that she lied about key events in her life, including her first divorce. Davis may even have lied under oath, testifying in a federal lawsuit over redistricting that, quote, I got divorced by the time I was 19 years old, unquote, when in fact she was divorced at age 21. Other missing details have included her second husband paid her way through law school and she divorced him the day after the last payment was made. Her ex-husband accused her in initial court filings of adultery and was awarded custody of their two daughters And she first ran for city council in Fort Worth as a Republican. Her only response to the paper was, "My language should have been tighter," admitting that her biography was less than truthful. So, Charlie, what's the damage here?
Considerable. Not that she had a chance. Anyway, I now, to borrow a phrase from her, think she's probably unviable. This is a salutary lesson for anyone who thinks that overnight candidacies and overnight stars can be made. She rocketed to fame because the press, which is overwhelmingly pro-choice, saw the chance to create an Obama-esque avatar for their movement. And somebody like her, who is admirable in some small way, and who is attractive, and who, as you say, exhibited certain easily mentionable features, the pink shoes, the content of the filibuster. And they thought, well, she was the one. And indeed, the left in Texas saw her very much in that vein as well. The Daily Coast immediately picked up and thought, well, she can win the state away from the Republicans. And there is a certain amount of buzz on the ground among Democrats in Texas. I've been down there quite a lot recently, and I've met with Greg Abbott as well. I profiled him for National Review, that really sees her as the one that can do it. As I say, this is the problem with overnight stars, is that they haven't been vetted, they haven't learned their trade. And now we're beginning to see that the backstory is falling apart, much as it has with similar stars on the right. Sarah Palin comes to mind. You know, I have a feeling that she will not do very well.
Charlie, just as an aside, Greg Abbott, the current Attorney General of Texas, whom you profiled, how impressed were you by him, and how excited should conservatives be about the prospect of him becoming governor next year?
Well, I think he's an impressive man. He has a very interesting life story. He was paralyzed in what can really only be described as a freak accident. A tree literally fell on him and broke his back when he was out running as a law student. And he decided while he was in hospital to become a politician rather than a lawyer. He's been a strong advocate against Obamacare. He's a strong advocate for gun rights. He's very much a conservative's conservative, and he really doesn't back down. He also has something of a rock star following. I was pretty amazed going around when he announced his candidacy to see venues that were supposed to hold 150 fans, that's how many had signed up online, you know, were turning people away because they'd hit their fire limit of 500, 600. He really does have quite the following. So, I mean, I think he's going to be governor of Texas, and possibly after that something more substantial even at the federal level.
Wow. Little nugget there to chew on. Charlie, as always, great to have you in for Jim today. We look forward to the next time. Thank you.
Absolutely. Have a good day.
Charlie Cook of National Review, in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Jim will be back on Tuesday. I'll be with him. Join us then for the next 3 Martini Lunch.